911, where is your emergency?
New Hope Plantation, Highway 17 North.
Okay, by New Hope, what's going on, ma'am?
There's a guy just came home and his whole family is dead. He's kind of hysterical. I can't understand. I haven't gone over there yet.
Okay, tell me what the address is. Try and get that address for me.
145, 146, and it's around to the back side.
New Hope Plantation?
Yes, ma'am. He just came screaming over up to my dog. My dog's a bite. He's got a dog out there, too, that on the porch that may bite. I'm going to have to try to contain him. This is Guy. I don't know what his last name is. He said his dad is dead. Rusty's dead. He said everybody's dead. I know there's it's a house full of people that live there.
Okay. What's his name? He's
freaking out. It's Guy.
Guy? What's his last name?
Well, Guy, what's your last name? What's your last name, honey? Huh? Yeah, here, talk to him. I just got what my whole family's doing.
Oh, okay, tell me what's going on, sir. What...
Hello and welcome to The Bourne Investigation, my new true crime podcast. Now, I've been asked to do a podcast for so long now, and I just feel like it's the right time to do it. I know that a lot of you guys like to listen to true crime to go to sleep. Some of you want to listen to more in-depth cases on your commute to work and things like that. So I feel like it's the right time to create this podcast. And I wanted to start it off by covering a case that I pretty much know inside out. And that is the case of the Glynn County mass murders. Now, I did cover this case way back when, probably over a year ago now, on my YouTube channel. So apologies if you have already watched that video. As I said, I just wanted to cover a case that I am really, really familiar with and a case that I'm really passionate about as well. Now, this is a case that I do have communication with a couple of the family members involved in this case. So I feel like I can give you a really accurate picture of what did go on in this case and why I feel so passionately about it as well, which you will see as this episode unfolds. So let's start with the basics. In August 2009, around 8:15 a.m., the Glynn County Police Department got a frantic phone call from a neighbour of 22-year-old Guy Hines Jr. The woman explained that Guy was hysterical and had just found his family dead in their trailer. Guy also speaks on the phone, sounding like he is in a lot of distress, and basically explains what he found that day. I'm going to play the recording of the 911 call. Just a warning, it is very distressing. It's pretty harrowing to hear the actual 911 call from this case. However, I do feel like it just adds so much and really is an amazing illustration of the panic and just the horrific nature of the crime that took place. So I'm going to play it now. Just a warning, as I said, it is very distressing.
Where is your emergency?
New Hope Plantation, Highway 17 North.
Okay, by New Hope, what's going on, ma'am?
There's a guy just came home and his whole family is dead. He's kind of hysterical. I can't understand. I haven't gone over there yet.
Okay, tell me what the address is. Try and get that address for me.
145, 146, and it's around to the back side.
New Hope Plantation?
Yes, ma'am. He just came screaming over up to my dog. My dog's a bite. He's got a dog out there, too, that on the porch that may bite. I'm going to have to try to contain him. This is Guy. I don't know what his last name is. He said his dad is dead. Rusty's dead. He said everybody's dead. I know there's it's a house full of people that live there.
Okay. What's his name?
He's freaking out. It's Guy.
Guy? What's his last name?
Well, Guy, what's your last name? What's your last name, honey? Huh? Yeah, here, talk to him. I just got what my whole family's doing.
Okay, tell me what's going on, sir. What?
I just got home just now, and everybody's dead.
Who?
I only got my dad's dead.
How many people are there?
There's like six, my whole family's dead.
Okay. Okay.
It looks like they've been beaten to death. I don't know, man.
Okay. Okay. Take a deep breath, Vic. I'm coming for you. Just stay on the line with me, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to get them out. They're coming for you.
Family's there.
How many people are there? Your dad? Who else is there?
My dad, my uncle, my cousins.
Where's he at right now, ma'am?
He's on the porch right now.
He's on the porch?
Uh-huh.
No fire and whatnot.
I still 911. I haven't gotten off the phone with him.
I'm going to say, is it okay if I stay on the line with you, ma'am, until they get there?
Okay, here's
okay.
My name is Mike. I'm the maintenance out here.
Okay, what's going on, Mike?
The guy that lives two doors out from me, his name is Guy Jr., I don't know his last name. He said his whole family's dead in here in the trailer. I'm standing right here in front of the trailer. I'm afraid to go in there.
No one should go in right now.
Okay, I call the manager. She's supposed to be over there in a minute.
Okay, yeah, we have everyone en route for you. We've got fire, EMS, and police coming to you. But I do want to stay on the line with somebody.
She said, tell them to hurry. Do you think Michael's still alive?
Someone's still alive?
Is Mike still breathing? I can't go in there.
Who's still alive? Which person?
He's a... young man, he's got Down syndrome.
So when police arrived at the trailer park, they found 7 people deceased and 2 others critically injured, including a 3-year-old. As you heard on the 911 call, the maintenance man had stated that there was someone still alive. And it kind of sounds like Guy shouts to him to tell him from the trailer and shouts to hurry because the person is breathing. Now, that person was Michael Toler, a 19-year-old with Down syndrome. The victims inside the trailer who were deceased were Russell Toler Sr., who was 44, along with his 3 children, Chrissy Toler, who was 22, Russell Toler Jr., who was 20, and Michelle Toler, who was 15. Guy's dad, Guy Hines Sr., was also deceased, and Michael Toler, who was 19, was rushed to hospital. Also killed inside the trailer was the elder Toler's sister, Brenda Falligan, who was aged 49, and Joseph West, the 30-year-old boyfriend of Chrissy Toler. Sadly, 19-year-old Michael Toler, the man with Down syndrome, died the following day in hospital. This made the total death count 8. So just a really harrowing scene to imagine that amount of people deceased inside a fairly small trailer. The videos of the crime scene are absolutely horrific. I feel like with the amount of true crime and things that I watch, documentaries, etc., I'm fairly desensitized to a lot of crime scenes that I see, but this one in particular really stuck with me and still stays with me now. I can still picture it really vividly. It is just such a horrific scene. The only way I can really describe it is really chaotic. There is just mess, blood, bodies, absolutely everywhere that you look. I don't actually usually start my cases with going straight into details of the crime scene, but I just felt like it was quite necessary in this case because the documentary that I watched about this case started this way and it really just grabbed my attention from the off and I wanted to know what on earth had happened. So we are now at this point going to rewind slightly to Guy Hines Jr. and his timeline of what he got up to in the day leading up to the horrendous discovery. I feel like it's only fair to get him to explain it in his own words. Now, this has been provided to me by his partner, Jody. I've got the handwritten copies of Guy's timeline and I've summarized the key points for you. Now, bear in mind, to Guy, this was just a normal day. He didn't wear a watch. He didn't carry a phone. This was back in 2009, bear in mind. So timings might actually be slightly off, as I'm sure if you put yourself in the position of trying to recall exactly what you did yesterday to exact timings, it would be quite difficult because you're not expecting to have to explain to people what you did every second of the day. So the date is August the 28th, 2009, and it's a Friday morning. It's around 7 a.m. and Guy gets up and goes to work. He meets his boss, Rich, at the trailer park entrance each morning and gets a lift to work. That was his normal routine. Now, Guy worked in construction and was building a house in Georgia. Around 11:30 to 12, they went to meet a contractor. Rich then dropped Guy and another colleague, Zach, off at Zach's apartment later, and Guy was unsure of the time of this. Guy and Zach planned to chill and then go to a bar later, and they went to a restaurant to eat at around 1 to 2 p.m. They then went back to Zach's and they smoked weed together and went to a golf/clothing store to buy an outfit to wear out that night. At this point, it's around 5:30 in the afternoon. On the way home, Guy bumped into his brother Tyler and some of his friends by the McDonald's. Tyler invited Guy to come to a hotel that they were staying in later that evening on that night, and Guy said he would let Tyler know. At this point, Guy calls Chrissy Toler and her boyfriend Joe to arrange for them to bring him some substances, and they agreed to come and get him. He decided at this point not to go back to Zach's, but doesn't remember if he rang to tell him that or not. So it's basically a Friday late afternoon after work, and Chrissy and Joe arrive about 30 minutes later. Joe sells substances, that was what he did, so he actually already had the substances for Guy with him at the time. Guy begins to smoke them in the car. They get to New Hope at around 7 p.m. and Guy believes that everyone was there from kind of what he recalls from that day. He shaved his head and he had a shower. Now, Guy's hairstyle is that he has a skinhead, so he shaved his head quite regularly. That was part of his routine for getting ready to go out. At this point, Russell Jr. gets a phone call from his brother saying that he wanted him to come to a motel and bring some tools to fix his battery cable. Guy thinks that this was at around 9 p.m. It was dark and it's August, so he kind of is guesstimating that it was around 9 p.m. Around 15 or 20 minutes later, roughly, they get to the motel that Russell Jr.'s brother is at. His girlfriend and two kids were also there, and they confirm that this was the case. They chilled there for a bit and he fixed the car. At this point, they leave and head back to New Hope, but they stop at a shop. And Guy recalls seeing a woman who works at a sandwich shop there, and the woman actually confirmed that she did see Guy at this time. So things are adding up from Guy's story up until this point. They get back home and everyone's still there. After a while, Guy decides to get up and go to the Friendly Express in New Hope to go and talk to a girl called Summer, who'd previously given Guy her number. He borrows Russell Jr.'s car and says that he doesn't remember what exact time it was, but he was aware that the store was open and it shuts at around 11:30 to 12 on a Friday, so it must have been before those hours. Now, after getting into Russell Jr.'s car, he actually ends up thinking he's too under the influence to go and see Summer at that point and ended up just going to a substance dealer's instead. He said he didn't really want Summer to see him like that. I think it only kind of hit him once he'd got in the car how under the influence he actually was. He drove around for a little bit, saw a man that he knew at a store and chatted to him. He then decided to head to Barrington Park. Now, this is a place that Guy knows is free from police. He'll have a bit of peace and quiet to kind of smoke and do what he wants to do, and it's just a nice sort of secluded area. Just prior to going to Barrington, he decided to go back to the trailer to get some more substances from Joe and Chrissy because he wanted to be stocked up for the night. This is kind of what he just did for enjoyment in the evenings, typically on a weekend. He went up to the window, which is usually what people used to do to get substances off Joe. Like I said, he was a known substance dealer. This is kind of what he just typically, he had this little window in the trailer. People would come up to the window and get substances from him. So Guy did that. He then headed to Barrington Park as planned and smoked there for a while under a tree. This is a place, as I said, he would kind of camp regularly there. And he thinks he was there for sort of around 2 hours, but he can't be exactly sure. Now, a while later, he decides to go to the hotel that his brother Tyler is staying at. So if you remember, earlier on in the evening, Tyler had invited him there previously. He knocked on Tyler's door, but nobody answered. So he went to Parker's, which was a place by the pier, at around 5 a.m. Now, this is a convenience store. And there is actually video CCTV evidence of Guy at Parker's at 5:36 a.m. Now, this was shown at the trial, which we'll get to later. But it's important to note that there is CCTV evidence of Guy just normal at the convenience store at 5:36 a.m. Guy then went back to the hotel and saw Tyler eventually and chilled there for a bit. Tyler then said he had to go and get his girlfriend and her friend back soon, so they all together left in his friend's car. Tyler and Guy dropped off Tyler's girlfriend and her friend, so then it was just Tyler and Guy together. They both went to get some food from a place called the Huddle House, and he then decided to go back to New Hope, which was his home, as he had things to do that day, and it was now daylight. And we know from the 911 call that this is around 8 a.m. Inside the trailer was a horrific scene, and I'm gonna let Guy himself explain what he found when he returned home in a recording that I'll insert now.
I seen Dad laying there, and I started shoving and shoving on the paddock, and then I ran down the hallway, and there was blood all over the place. That's when I went in the back bedroom, and I seen the shotgun laying right there by the window. I seen the shotgun on the ground, and my first instinct was to pick up the shotgun. I picked up the shotgun. And then, so, the point I think I need to run back to the house, and I don't know what's going on. So I'm thinking to go back to the back bedroom where I know Michelle and all of me. And I'm running back there, still got a shotgun, there's blood everywhere, there's blood all over the place, so. And I see the floor, I'm thinking I need to call 911, I need to get help, I need to call 911. So I pick up the cell phone, I see you laying by Michelle, I pick up the cell phone. There's no business on it. So yeah, I can't call 911, I just had it in my hand. I must have put it in my pocket. I must have put it in my pocket because I'm still looking for the corner phone because I know I can't call 911 because it's not working. So then I run back. I ain't sure exactly if I ran right out of the house then. I think I ran back in the bedroom because I know Michael was back there. He was on the bed. He looked like he was still breathing. And in the most of the time, the shorts that I had on, the bottom shorts, the gym shorts were lower than the shorts that I had on, okay? This is how the blood got there, on these shorts. And I'm running through this crime scene. Picture this crime scene, there's blood everywhere. I go back to the back bedroom of Michael. I get back on the bed, I'm on knee first on the bed, and I got blood on my shorts, obviously I got it on there, so I got it on all the ones underneath me, it's easily explained. And then, amongst this time, I ran outside screaming. And the neighbor, Peggy, I can't remember her last name, that's the one who ended up calling 911. And she came over there and I started talking to 911. But in the most of the time, I went to the car and I'm shocked and I'm panicked.
So obviously it's very harrowing to hear Guy explain what he found when he got to the trailer. He stated the first person he saw was his dad lying on the mattress and it looked like someone had tore his face up. He was completely unrecognizable. He then saw a pair of legs on the kitchen floor and realized this was Russell Toler Jr. Guy obviously is in a very panicked state. I mean, he's under the influence from the night before, so he's not really thinking clearly, and he has just found the most horrific murder scene anybody could ever find. So he ran and saw a shotgun on the floor, and he said his first instinct was to pick it up. He then also grabbed a phone from the back bedroom and tried to call 911, and the phone doesn't work. Now, I'm unsure if this was maybe a phone issue or maybe Guy was too panicked or under the influence to dial 911 and get the phone to work. I know personally when I've tried to do simple tasks when being panicked or being drunk, it can kind of make you lose all coordination, and maybe if you're shaking, like, you might not be able to dial the phone correctly. He then ran outside screaming and his neighbor Peggy phones the police for him. Now, I obviously played the phone call from when the neighbor rang 911, and there is actually a bit cut out of the original police recording. Presumably, I got that recording off YouTube, presumably to make it YouTube friendly. There was a section where the 911 operator asked Guy what it looked like in the trailer, and I believe Guy said something along the lines of, "It looks like an effing murder scene." I'll discuss jurors in the trial in more detail later on, but one juror expressed feeling like he was acting like a smart aleck to the operator. Now, I don't personally have a criminal justice background, but I do have a psychology degree and I work in mental health. And to be honest, I didn't hear somebody acting like a smart aleck. I heard somebody in shock and in a huge amount of distress. It doesn't sound like he's intentionally trying to be difficult. He just sounds like he is incredibly distraught and can't really process what he's just seen. At this point in the case, Guy was taken to the station when the police turned up and questioned for around 14 hours. Now, bearing in mind, rightly or wrongly, he's coming off drugs at this point, I would question whether it was appropriate for him to be questioned at all under the influence. He was then taken to county jail and charged with possession of substances. He was also charged with tampering with evidence for moving the shotgun from the trailer, but it is important to note that the shotgun was in no way related to the murders. He was then kept in jail until the 4th of September, until he was released on bond. He was picked up by his grandma and his brother Tyler, and police actually followed them home. About 10 minutes after returning home, they knocked and said that the bail had been revoked, and they put him in the car and took him back to jail. They then charged him with the murders of 8 people. He then spent a shocking 4 years of his life in jail just waiting for a trial. So this next section is going to be all about the trial itself. Bear in mind, as I said, he has waited 4 years for this trial now. I think the autopsy results play a huge part in this case. Now, I'm not going to go through every single injury detail on every single person because we would be here for so long. But just as an example, there were 48 injuries on Michelle Tola alone. Another victim had 36. And there were 8 people deceased. So think about how long it would take one person to inflict 48 injuries on a person, then for argument's sake, add 36 for the next person, then another 48, then another 36. And that's only half of the victims. It actually took 2 full days for the jury to hear all of the injuries on all of the victims. Now, I'm not saying that just to illustrate how horrific this crime is, which it obviously is. I'm saying that to illustrate how long this must have taken if this was one perpetrator. The fractures on Guy's dad's head were said to be so extreme they're only usually seen in car crashes or when somebody fell out of a building. That's how extreme the trauma was to Guy's dad's head. And I find it incredibly difficult to believe that one person alone could cause this amount of damage to 8 individuals. I think it would be incredibly difficult for one person to inflict this amount of damage on 8 people if they were restrained. But bear in mind, none of the victims were tied up in any way. And the autopsy doctor, Dr. Donahue, admitted to knowing of no other comparable case. The prosecution stated it would have taken around 2 to 3 hours to go around systematically killing these victims. Michael Knox, who was the forensic consultant and an expert in crime scenes, states that there is nothing, actually nothing, that put Guy in the trailer at the time of the murder. He stated that the crime scene is very clear that one person would not have been physically able to carry out the attacks alone. Now, there's evidence, distressingly, to show that Russell Tola fought back quite a bit. The blood spatter indicates that he was being attacked from 2 different sides. Therefore, either one person would have had to have been running from different sides of the bed, getting him from different angles if it was just one perpetrator, or the more feasible alternative is that there was more than one attacker there. The bedroom where Brenda was killed had no blood spatter on the wall next to her, interestingly. And the reason being that a pillow was held over her while she was being attacked. Now, I know it's quite gruesome to think about, but if you think a pillow held with one hand and the other hand is being used to attack somebody. So that's quite feasible. However, Brenda also had marks on her left arm where she was being held down. So unless Guy grew an extra arm, there was clearly, in the forensic consultant's opinion, another person there at the time of the attack. There was also more distressing evidence on other victims' bodies that they were being held by their ankles while they were attacked. Michael Knox, the forensic consultant, testified that in his opinion, it had to be around five people carrying out the attacks. So let's look at some other evidence now. None of the bodies were processed for fingerprints, which they obviously should have been if this was a sort of thoroughly investigated crime scene. So that was lost evidence. Police also failed to collect evidence that they photographed of clothing in the bathroom with blood spots on it. None of the victims were in the bathroom, so this item of clothing had to come from someone else, and police never tested or even collected this evidence. Another piece of evidence that was shown at the trial were some shorts and some undershorts. Now, there was the blood of three different people on these shorts, which the prosecution argued was evidence that Guy was there during the murders. These were shorts that Guy was wearing. However, what we do know is that he was in the trailer. Yeah, he ran into the trailer. He ran to the victims. He was trying to find a phone. The trailer was covered in blood. And when I say covered, honestly, if you have the opportunity to watch the documentary, which I'll talk about in a little bit, please do watch it, because it's absolutely insane the amount of blood and bodies that are in that trailer. So I would say it would actually be less suspicious that he did have blood on him. I'd argue that if he was there during the murders, he would be covered. He would have a lot more than just three small dots of the victim's blood on him. So what was the murder weapon that was used in this case? Now, this is quite controversial. It's not actually known. The weapon was never found, but police claim it would have had to have been a large blunt instrument. Prosecutors argued that the motive of the crime was substance related and that Guy committed the crime under the influence of strong substances. Now, we know he was on substances. That's a given, and Guy has said, yeah, that's exactly what he was doing that evening. But neighbours actually witnessed him return home and then leave the trailer in the panic and call 911. So if we rewind a little bit to earlier on in the morning, it was around 1 a.m. and Guy stated that he'd been at that campground known as Barrington Park. But a Mr. Thomas Williams from the campground stated that he never saw Guy that evening. And that was actually what was used to arrest Guy. However, when he was questioned during the trial, Mr. Williams admitted he'd been asleep by 10 p.m. So, yeah, of course you didn't see Guy. Guy stated that it was around 1 a.m. that he was at Barrington Park. So he wouldn't have known either way whether Guy was there or not. This next part of this case really enrages me, because there is just something so clearly wrong about this whole investigation, and this will become quite clear now. A local woman called Gail Montgomery actually found what she described as nunchucks and a hammer covered in blood, and called the police to tell them about this. Now, if you remember, a large blunt instrument is what police believe to have been the murder weapon in this case, and the murder weapon has apparently never been found. So Gail stated that a police officer called Mike Owens came and he collected the items. But police deny this, and the officer who Gail claims collected the items but denies their existence, Mike, interestingly, was previously investigated and admitted to mishandling evidence in another case. If this doesn't scream police corruption, I do not know what does. Guy, though, was shockingly, in my opinion, found guilty and sentenced to life without parole. So a couple of times in this episode, I've referenced a documentary, which is a BBC documentary called Life and Death Row. And one episode focuses purely on Guy's case and it follows the trial. It follows Guy's grandma Jean and his brother Tyler and just kind of gives you a little bit of a overview of their kind of upbringing and what the family was like and what Guy was like really. And Guy's grandma Jean said that Guy had never been a confrontational person. Guy was actually 17 when his mum tragically died from a drug overdose. So there's trauma there from quite an early age. I think what kind of fascinated me and enraged me at the same time about the documentary was the really in-depth look at the jurors and the thought processes of the jurors throughout the trial. And it's really interesting because you just don't often get such a fly-on-the-wall kind of look at who jurors are and how they make their decisions and the kind of rationale that they give. One of the jurors were asked about their first impressions of Guy. Now, bear in mind, this is first impressions. So this is literally just as he walks into the trial. And one stated that from his face, so just from his face, they could tell that he had, quote, no remorse and no feelings. I just felt that that statement alone showed the absolute prejudice that a jury member had prior to even hearing a word out of Guy's mouth, hearing any evidence, knowing anything about the case. Like, how can you tell from someone's face that they had no remorse and no feelings? The statement alone, I felt, just suggested a presumption of guilt, and that was before the trial had even begun. So I felt like Guy had a real uphill battle against these jurors. Maybe, you know, his blank facial expression was due to fear, due to the trauma that he's experienced, or maybe just due to being sat in prison for 4 years awaiting a trial. I don't know how we can have a so-called justice system that is so flawed. It really was quite eye-opening to watch in the documentary. I mean, humans just naturally make assumptions, make judgments about people based on so many different factors that can just obviously cause so much bias in the courtroom. Then when jurors were discussing the images shown in the trial of Guy's relatives' dead bodies, one juror commented, "I just wish he would have paid attention." Now, they interpreted him not looking at the image as disinterest. I don't know about anyone else, but if I was being shown an image of a relative of mine with a beaten-in skull, I'm not sure I could look at that. Actually, I'm pretty certain I couldn't look at that. I also looked away while they showed the images on the documentary. Now, I'm not looking away because I'm bored. I'm actively interested in the documentary and I'm choosing to watch it. I'm looking away because they are incredibly disturbing images and they're not even my relatives. So I cannot imagine how Guy felt having that all played out in front of him on a huge projector screen. Several jury members admitted that during this trial, they were confused for the majority of it, not just a little bit of it, the majority of it. It also sounded like it was incredibly chaotic during the deliberations, and they said people were crying, people were disagreeing, having arguments. Apparently, one juror had to be removed due to this. Now, that just shows how bad it was in there. If you do have access to BBC iPlayer, I would really recommend watching the documentary just so you can see what a shit show it really was, because it is awful. To a certain extent, I understand like humans' need for some kind of resolution. And I feel like maybe that took over in this case. It's obviously an incredibly harrowing crime. Obviously, they've seen hideous things in that trial, and part of me feels like they almost just wanted a nice neat little resolution to it. They want to feel like somebody has taken, you know, is going to be held responsible for this crime, is what I'm trying to say, I think. And I kind of feel that alone was the driving force behind finding Guy guilty, because realistically, if they didn't find Guy guilty, nobody is held accountable for this crime. And it's very unsettling to think that somebody or people who did those horrific murders are just walking free, which personally I believe is the case. I do think that the people who actually committed the crime have just got away with it. Now, as I said, I have been in communication with Guy and his partner Jodie, and Guy actually has put forward some kind of theories himself of what may have happened to his family members. He states that he doesn't know who did it, but has an idea of who may have done it slash been involved.
Do you know or have any idea who may have done this? That's like one of the most popular questions.
I don't know who did it. I have an idea who did it. The cartel. And this is so hard for everybody to believe. Because, listen, nobody in that house did anything to deserve that period. There was only one person in the house, and I'm not speaking ill of them. Joe. Joe sold drugs. And I'm not saying Joe did anything he didn't deserve what happened in period. But he had a shrimp boat. And where I come from, the cartel, that's how drugs come in, on shrimp boats, okay? And that's the only thing that I can put together. What happened? Joe was supposed to bring something in on the ship boat. They messed up the money, messed up something, or didn't want to do it again. That's how it happens too. And this is so hard for people that don't know nothing about this life or never been in this life or never been on the boat to understand. You can't wrap your mind around it. But the cartel is controlled there. I don't know for a fact that the cartel did, that's what had this done. And where we're from, shrimp boats, everything comes in on shrimp boats. That's the only thing that I can wrap my mind around what happened.
Guy feels, and I have to say, I think I agree with him, that it was drug related. He states, as we've talked about, Joe was known to sell drugs. He actually had a shrimp boat as well. And Guy says that he has racked his brains. The only thing that he could think of is that perhaps Joe was supposed to get a shipment of drugs or something. It didn't go ahead. The cartel wanted revenge. You know, I don't think it's out of the realms of possibility that it was drug related. I think the sheer amount of people who were killed screams like a revenge cartel kind of killing. It was clearly, in my opinion, quite systematic. The fact that these people were all killed in their beds, it's not like it was a random spur of the moment thing. There was a disagreement. There was people involved. It was people entered this trailer in the middle of the night and systematically killed this entire family. I just don't know who would be so evil as to do that unless it was gang related, unless it was cartel related. As it stands, Guy is still in jail for this crime, and unfortunately his younger brother Tyler, who you see in the documentary, has actually passed away. Now, I must admit, I had a real soft spot for Tyler in the documentary. You just feel every single emotion that Tyler feels. I feel like he wears his heart on his sleeve. He's quite an open book, and he's relentlessly positive and really, really hopeful that Guy will be found not guilty. And my heart just broke when I watched the documentary and saw his reaction in the courtroom. It is really, really heartbreaking, and he passed away. And Guy is still trying to get the word out about his case. And I personally believe that there are serious flaws in the evidence, or lack of evidence in this case, especially things that have miraculously gone missing that could be key forensic elements. I've got a little audio clip that I want to include at the end of this podcast ep, just from Guy. He recorded it in jail, and his partner Jodie kindly sent it over to me.
Thank you, Charlie, for making the video. You're amazing. Thank everybody for watching the video. You're all even more amazing. And please, everybody, join Guy's voice and get as many people that you can to join Guy's voice. God bless you all.
Thank you so much for listening to the first episode of the Bourne Investigation. I really hope that it has been interesting and that you've learned something. As I said, go and watch that documentary. Please go and see for yourself the crime scene. Let me know what you think about this case. I'm so interested to hear your feedback. And hopefully I will see you all on the next episode.